Hello and welcome to the International Trade Resource Podcast, your go-to source for insights and information on all aspects of international trade. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a trade professional, or just curious about the global marketplace, we've got you covered. From customs regulations to export strategies, from emerging markets to international finance, we explore the latest trends and best practices that drive global commerce. Our host, Kim Kirkendall, sits down with a diverse range of experts who navigate the complex world of international trade and help you stay ahead of the game. So get ready to learn about the ins and outs of international trade on the International Trade Resource Podcast.
Hello, listeners. I'd love to welcome you to another episode of International Trade Resources Podcast. And we have a fantastic guest with us today, Scott Schofield with CoView. He's a very accomplished entrepreneur, a lot of different business and investment opportunities under his belt. But what we're talking with him about today is the company CoView that he has now is specialized in importing products into Japan, providing a platform for those companies, end-to-end market access solution for various brands and OEMs from Europe, the US, and around the world. So he has just a tremendous amount of experience on how to enter the Japanese market. And what we want to focus on today is the more technical compliance side of that. So thank you so much, Scott, for being here.
Thank you for asking me. Pleasure to be here.
I was joking when we started because, you know, usually on these cross net world calls, either I have a glass of wine and they have a cup of coffee. They have a glass of wine. I have a cup of coffee, but he's sticking with water today. So going to make sure he stays focused on this podcast for you guys. So I want to ask you about import regulations in terms of Japan. For starters, let's step back a second and talk about different categories of regulations, because these can be different from country to country. So specifically in Japan, what are the different categories that would apply to an importer?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about the categories, I think of them in terms of what is the process of getting into the country. So the categories, the biggest category is obviously non-regulated. And that's kind of a misleading term, non-regulated, because when you're coming into Japan, import compliance is ambiguous by design in this country. It is an export country, and getting in here is ambiguous to keep you out. So you have non-regulated, then you have, and those kind of products would be something like home goods or textiles, mattresses, for example. But even those, even though they're non-regulated, from a compliance standpoint, let's say for consumer affairs, once you're in the market, they also have some form of compliance that's required from a selling standpoint. The next one would be products that require an import application or notification for every shipment. And that would include things like food apparatus, infant and toys under six products, and even CBD. And then you move into product lines that require an overall approval from a government agency. Example of that would be electronics that are subject to PSE or Japan Radio. And then moving into things like cosmetics, personal care items, quasi drugs, medical devices. These all require an application process, a general approval. And then once approved through the compliance company, whoever's handling the compliance side, can start to ship without having an ongoing application.
So what I'd like to draw the listeners' attention to is that you've got the regulatory, what we think of as regulatory aspects, which, as you mentioned, you know, medical devices, electronics with PSE, but then you also have non-regulated aspects that still really are regulations and their expectations or laws the government has in place that would include labeling. You know, for example, the product labeling has to be different. And then one of the things I think is interesting that you mentioned is import application. And I think there's specialized or a different system in Japan than I'm used to about how you have to import. So can you talk to us a little bit about that? What's the import process and what might surprise people about what you need to have in place to import?
So dropping back into what you talk about, that non-regulated. So for a moment, just on the compliance side, if you have a product like a mattress, for example, it's a non-regulated product from an import compliance standpoint. However, from a selling standpoint, you would have some labeling that requires recovery time, basic information like who the importer is, the seller, made-in materials, and so forth. That kind of data has got to be on the product label, which is required. A lot of sellers don't, especially with the onset of e-commerce really exploding throughout the world, right? A lot of e-commerce sellers don't realize that, yes, you can come into this country non-regulated, but by the time you start selling, you've got a layer of compliance that needs to be implemented. If you fail to do that, it just takes a couple of complaints to consumer affairs that would keep you out of the market or be penalized. So when you talk about process, though, and I use the word application, it depends on what country you're in, but I guess the standard verbiage would be notification. But I use application because it truly is an application. You're seeking permission. You're not actually notifying someone. An application, for instance, like with food or something that falls into those categories, it builds out a lot of data. And you think about it from things that people don't realize. If you're, for example, on the food side, you're building this application. This application includes everything from your manufacturing process, flow process in detail, and then also your ingredient list by percentage. So what does that equal? That equals your recipe. And a lot of companies don't realize that this kind of data is required. It's mandatory on the application.
On all products imported into Japan?
No. So these would be products that are going to be falling into the import application side. So food would require this. CBD products, for instance, would need that. And a lot of CBD manufacturers do not like to give up their distilling and their flow process, their distilling methods on how they're getting to a finished product. But a lot of sellers use contract manufacturing. And when they're using contract manufacturing, they need to make sure that the relationship is very tight with that manufacturer, because the disclosure of that information is required to build this application. Ongoing with that is the nutritional labeling, the compliance side of things, the nutritional labeling and the product labeling side of it, your claims behind it. If you're talking about food supplements, what are you claiming behind the package? There are a lot of things in Japan that cannot be, you cannot make a claim. You can't say this is going to resolve heart problems, for instance. Or if you look at for a cosmetic side of product, let's say scar cream, which is very popular around the world on Amazon. Scar cream cannot be stated as scar cream here. There's no such thing in the eyes of the government. So anyway, you're building this application, and it includes things, everything from even lab testing. If it's a food apparatus, for instance, like a frying pan, they want to know the materials. And if it's got some type of material on it that they don't particularly like, or they want more information on, they may request a material test on that for a result. For food, obviously they're going to seek it on a lot of food. Certainly on CBD, end of story, every single shipment is going to be stopped into Japan customs. It'll be tested at an MHLW lab within customs and moves forward. So in that case, in the case of a CBD product, we never even recommend the client go forward with the testing, because there's no point. Whatever you submit is going to be thrown out, and they're going to do their own testing on it. So this application is built up. You submit it. The final data behind that is, you know, your port of entry, and they're going to be waiting for it at the end of it. What's interesting, I mean, is this can take up to 60 days to build an application for food or food apparatuses or food supplements in that regard, or even CBD. And once you get that heavy lifting done, though, if you've got a good importer of record, you have a good company dialed in, they should be able to replicate those applications on reshipments and get approval within 3 to 5 days. But the first one's quite a bit of time, and I don't think a lot of brands understand the time involved behind that particular thing. When you talk about cosmetics, a little different. I mean, it depends on the company that's handling it, but it can take anywhere from 28 days to 60 days again. And again, you're talking about there may be requests for lab testing and a lot of other data built behind it, but it needs to be completed and in terms of the application before you can actually and approved before you start shipping.
That's interesting because it's separate from any other, I'm assuming, right? And this is a question, but is it separate from any other application you might also have to have with PSE or the FDA, right? This is a separate process, this import application. Or does it, is there some connection or overlap?
Yeah, there are a few overlaps. Like for instance, if you're working on like a consumer medical device, that product may be electronic. But as it's moving through the FDA process, which by the way is PMDA here, you still may be very compliant in terms of PSE, but they'll handle that as an overlap as the medical device is going through.
So I'm imagining the import application is online somewhere and you are going in and you're filling all of this out. Once I fill that out, I have to go into a separate agency's website and also do my PSE application and process separately, correct?
No, you as an outsider can't do this. You have to use a company with...
Okay, that's great to know. So someone in Japan that's registered would do this. Would they go in two different locations to enter that information?
No, they wouldn't. So as I said, Japan's a very interesting, you know, you think of Japan as being this very, very high-tech country and modern country. And in a lot of areas, we have that. I mean, our toilets are one of them. But when you talk about the country, the agencies themselves, they are very digitally challenged. And a lot of their processes are not like that. They're not online. You may be transmitting data, for instance, in customs clearance to customs via NACS, but these applications are not transferred digitally. And I'll give you an example of that. In the case of, let's say, the products I was talking about for the import applications on cosmetics and quasi-drugs and so forth, those are actually completed on a template that you're provided with a limited-based app on a computer that you have in your, in our office. And then it is burned on a CD and mailed. That is their idea of security, and it is moved over. And the process for doing this, there is no online banter or discussions or email conversations. It is a one-on-one conversation. It either happens by, usually happens by telephone. It wasn't too long ago that it happened by fax. But this is an ongoing conversation about the application, and there is no exchange of online conversations. And it's a very challenging process because when I talk to you about it, not about it being ambiguous, that also means from the standpoint of learning how to do this process. I'll date myself a little bit, but if you think about the movie Karate Kid, you had Mr. Miyagi who was wax on, wax off, training someone, never explaining why. And that's literally how a lot of the compliance people today who handle compliance in Japan have learned. They've learned from years and years of trial and error, working with various projects, and it's been a passed down form of art. That's something from my standpoint that was extremely frustrating and something we had to put an end to. So for us, we built knowledge bases within our organization because we don't want a food specialist not able to also cross over into cosmetics. But overall, when you're talking to the agency, you're having a conversation with an agent and they're assigned to your case. And in some areas, we've actually seen contradictions where they'll approve one product and they'll decline another product, but they're the exact same product, manufactured, white labeled, out of the same manufacturer. It's very interesting.
So just before we leave this topic, you mentioned that there are products that do not need an import application, but those products coming into the country would still have other requirements. You mentioned an importer of record. So let's talk about without an application, outside of or besides the application, what other steps do companies have to go through to import into Japan, including the importer of record?
Before I go into that, let's back up and talk about import for a moment. There are really two types of import. There's an import where you are sending a product into Japan and you are either transferring ownership to a buyer and in the form of like a reseller or a distributor. Then there is an import of a product where you're retaining ownership of the product and you're selling it on an e-commerce format or a marketplace. And so those are products coming into the country and exchanging ownership at some point in time. And then you have what we have cross-border, which is personal import. personal imports very interesting because in the fact that you can sell a product, you're going to sell it to a buyer, an end buyer here in this country, and it's going to come in directly to them, and they are taking full responsibility for the liability, all the risk. It's not a great way to sell, by the way, from an e-commerce perspective, but especially in Japan. But they're taking, that buyer is taking and assuming all of the risk, and they're going to pay their sales tax on entry, or the shipper is going to do it, one or the other. And there is no real compliance in a lot of areas. You don't need, for instance, a cosmetic can come in. The problem you have is that on the books, Japan has a tremendous amount of rules about how much you can ship on a personal import, what the cap limit it is when you at some point either need to form an entity in Japan or you need to get an importer of record. That importer of record, by the way, can be a company that is neutral and importer of record like ours, or it can be the actual buyer if they're licensed to do so and bring it in. But this personal import cross-border has been very, very popular. What's happening today is that Japan realized they're missing out on a lot of tax revenue. They're also missing out on being able to enforce a lot of compliance and safety issues. So they're now that they've kind of elevated themselves with their digital tools, they're starting to now enforce the laws that have been on the books for a long time. That may be that you can sell the equivalent of, let's say, $10,000 on personal import it before you need to kick over into having an importer of record or having a distributor bring in the product. The other one is this where we're bringing the products in either as a distributor or you're selling it on e-commerce. Once you're selling on e-commerce, you are now a seller, just like your distributors or retailers would be. And you are required to comply with basically the consumer affairs side of things. And that is not written anywhere. Nowhere, if you were sitting around, let's say you're an Amazon seller, you don't find this in Seller Central. You don't find this anywhere. But you are required to have a product label, and that product label has got to be completely in Japanese. It's got to convey a few things. For instance, you're the seller, your information, where the product was made. If it's a mattress, for instance, I would mention that, you know, the recovery time data has to be tested and provide the recovery time. In fact, I've seen a seller actually get reported for not having that data on their label. And, you know, if they didn't rectify it quickly, at first it was a financial fine to them. But if they didn't get it rectified, they had to remove all the stock out of the country until it was done, or get it labeled and get it tested and finished. That's what they chose to do. But there are a series of little things that you need to put into it. Hang tag information like care on your products, how to iron them, how to wash them. All of that has to be done with Japanese symbols, their standard, not the international standard. So you've got this array of little nuances in labeling and compliance as a seller that you need to follow. And you'll very, very rarely hear anyone talk about it because it isn't really written anywhere. It's just this known thing. You can go into consumer affairs. If you speak great Japanese, you can call in and find out what all you need. There are some sites where you can go in and see some things, but all that detail is not listed out. It's kind of a handed down process. Even local Japanese get consultants to help them.
So let's pick two agencies now. Let's pivot from import a little bit to more the product regulation side. Let's talk about PSE and PMDA. So for those two agencies, from a high level, what is the process a foreign company would need to follow to have products that fall under one of those agencies to get those products into the country?
All right. Well, I'll take what's going to be the easier one first, and then we'll get into PMDA. But PSE products, that's electronics that are subject to PSE regulation. And also, keynote is Japan Radio. So that agency there is the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, METI. MITI is how we go by it. And a product, it's pretty straightforward. If you have a product that emits a radio wave, it is required to be Japan radio compliant. So how does that work? Well, first of all, it works with the manufacturing plant, not with the OEM, not with the brand, but where it's being produced. And that plant has to receive, I'm going to use for a lack of a better word, I'm going to use a certification, but it is a, you would go to a company like maybe a TÜV Rhineland or some authorizing, you know, entity that does kind of like an ISO process. And that plant would get and apply for a Japan radio certification, which is also AKA a license. You're issued a license number and it is specific to these products. And they will need to have some labeling of that PSE radio mark has to be on the product. It's got to be there with the license number and so that it's verifiable. So in the process of getting the products approved, you're going to be providing a lot of information to your importer of record because the outside company can't do this. You need a licensed company that, by the way, that is capable of doing it for Japan Radio. And they're going to supply all of this data. And it starts with the product information, its use, its claims, its the manual and how it works. There's technical data that goes behind that as well. So they may even ask for the schematics or the details on the processors. It will move forward into, you know, how is it being used? If that's all okay, then it'll get approved and it's an overall approval. You don't need to do this again. That product will be approved under that Japan IOR and it will be labeled up and it can be shipped into the country, provided that it's fully compliant. When you talk about products that are electronic, that are taking, let's say, a user accessible lithium ion battery, specifically, that means that you as the consumer, and I think a great one to talk about are toothbrushes, the ultrasonic toothbrushes or electronic toothbrushes. In the past, they were a sealed device. We got eco-friendly and we said we should be really swapping these batteries out instead of doing the thing where we're throwing it away. The problem with Japan is as soon as it's user accessible, it's PSE regulated. That's too bad because now all of the toothbrushes that come into this country are sealed and they're just throwing them away because they cannot be serviced. But this is PSE. If you are also a product that takes power from AC, which is wall or mains power, you're plugging into the wall. These products are subject to PSE, and there's a process for that. There are two types of PSEs. There's a circle PSE and a diamond PSE. One, the process for both of them for entry and application are identical except for one little point. So you're going to build again this data. It's going to be about the product, the manufacturing plant. You're going to supply your certification. In the case of Circle, you just need to send a copy of it, an email copy, a scanned copy of that certification that says that you are compliant to MET, Japan MET standards. It will also show the products that are authorized under that certification. So it will actually list the model numbers of those products. They have to be on that piece of paper. The next one would be your technical data and then the labeling. It'll go through a process. The diamond one is a little different in the fact that, you know, you don't send a scanned copy. You have to go back to the issuing body and request a certified copy that has to be sent to the manufacturer. And then the manufacturer would send it to the IOR and the IOR would then forward it on to MITI because they want the actual certified copy of it to look at. Then there's this little kind of unknown that a lot of people don't realize is the products actually, in the case of diamond ones, have to be tested. Every single product has to be tested within a certain set of parameters. Those parameters, by the way, are defined at the time of the application. MITI will come back to you and say, that's great. For these products, we want you to test them this way. Every product has to be tested.
When you say every product, you mean every piece in an order.
Every piece that, just the piece that is subject to let's say PSE.
Right. But let's say we order 10,000 pieces, you know, from wherever, from Mexico that are going into Japan. They have to prove that all 10,000 of those pieces were properly tested, correct?
Not only do they have to prove it, they have to provide the test report.
Right. Right. That's their proof. So I understand a lot of what you're talking about, and I don't know about our listeners, but it's very similar to CE mark in Europe, CCC in China. It's different from the US because we have a voluntary system with UL. and it is not as heavily regulated. As one of my colleagues likes to say, the U.S. relies on litigation for regulation. We just sue each other. So you're careful about your product quality so you don't get sued and lose millions of dollars, you know, in a lawsuit, but we don't necessarily regulate it the same way. What about PMDA? Let's just switch to that for a second. What are some of the nuances of PMDA that would be different than PSE?
Okay, so PMDA is for pharmaceuticals and medical devices. It is a much lengthier process. It would depend on what you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a pharmaceutical, that is, let's say, a quasi-drug or a, let's say, an OTC, over-the-counter. If you're dealing with medical devices, depending on what class of medical device that is, or whether it's a consumer device or a B2B device, you know, hospital device or clinic device, the process is a very lengthy process. So if you're looking at some area, I'll give you some examples that are kind of interesting in their kind of market protectionist side of it. If you look at massage guns in Japan are a class two medical device. Same with the massage chairs. So there are some really great brands internationally that have been kept out of the market. So doing that requires not only your application of your product, but you have to register the manufacturer as a foreign manufacturer in the country under the IOR with PMDA. That may also include, especially if it's class two, a site visit. They're going to audit the site. They're going to look at their quality following something like an ISO 13485. If they don't have 13485, probably will not get approved because Japan likes to look at a lot of processes and has adopted some international standards. But this process is building a lot of compliance for the import side of it. But what you also don't realize is that the post-sale support compliance is about five times greater on that. It includes customer care, installations, ability to do recalls, parts support. There is a large breadth of infrastructure that is needed to support certain classes of medical devices. And all the way down to, I shouldn't say certain classes, even including a class one medical device, it's a consumer product. There are these areas that you have to worry about. Something I want to mention about those kind of products under PMDA, and also this would also include things like quasi-drugs and cosmetics and personal care items, which fall under, by the way, PMDA, because they regulate it like a drug. The dirty little secret in this country is that whomever handles the import compliance for this brand is going to control their import rights no matter what's on paper. Doesn't matter what kind of contract you have with your importer of record or your distributor. If they handled your import compliance, they own your import rights indefinitely until they release them. And that very, very rarely happens for a number of reasons. One, they may want to leverage that for money, right? Capital to get something. They also may want to just hold your product out of the market while they scale something else. So I've seen time and again, a lot of brands will come in here and they think, this import compliance for PMDA is so lengthy and so difficult. I don't want to do it. My distributor is raising their hand up saying, don't worry. Well, they've given up all their rights. The next time they want to add a distributor or they want to do something else, they need the permission of the original compliance handler, and the product's got to go through them, because all products that fall under these categories of PMDA require that the product land at the licensed facility for compliance inspections before they can move on to wherever they're going, whether that be an end customer, another distributor, or whatever. It has to come into the licensed facility that it was originally registered on, follow an IQC, an incoming quality inspection, and documentation behind it, and then it can move on from there. So from that date forward, I would always say, If you're an OEM or a brand, before you give up your rights because you think it's too difficult, really, really consider what you're doing, because you will be held out of the market. Relationships come in.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point, because I'm sure you've seen professionally And I can imagine, I've had clients in other markets that very often start off with a distributor that they've half qualified, you know, that approach them at a trade show or someone else they know knows someone else that knows them. And they may not be the most capable or the best in the market or have the best distribution network, but they think, oh, that's okay. We'll get started with this. We'll build up our trade knowledge. Eventually, we can have our own office or we can have multiple distributors. And what I'm hearing you say is that's not going to work. That's not going to work. Or you're going to have a lengthy negotiation with that initial distributor, importer of record, you know, for them to pass the rights on to someone else.
Correct. For them to delist the product, then more than likely, you're going to be paying a hefty price to do that. And they may not always agree they want to do it. Probably the only way to work around that would be that you'd have to launch your own company. And you can't, if it's a regulated product, launching your own company and let's say getting into cosmetics or doing a class one medical device or something like that, you're into it for 3 years before you're even going to be getting into the product and selling it in the market space, because you need to develop the company first. You have to put in all of the infrastructure, and the licensing is back behind people. Those people have to be on payroll. They cannot be, you know, contract employees. They got to be licensed. They've got to be accredited. They're coming in on your payroll and they're handling the whole process of setting up your ISO, your infrastructure. You're getting your application to PMDA as well as a facility so that you can get both the manufacturing slash import license as well as the sales and marketing. It's a very lengthy process, and you can't, you know, starting that really doesn't help if you haven't already had the distributor delist the products that they registered under you in the first place. But you could get a workaround on it by saying you are the original, the OEM behind it or the brand owner. They would allow that to happen. We've actually personally handled that from another company, but it does take a lot of time.
It sounds
bringing a company into Japan has no strategic value until you're somewhere around $50 million USD. And that really depends on the product.
Yeah. We're at the end here of our podcast. But if nothing else, Scott, you have warned us sufficiently that this is not the market to assume anything in or to go into, you know, lightly, right? You definitely need to do your research. Very clearly, you have to have a partner on the ground. And that partner on the ground, you know, hopefully will be as transparent with you as Scott has been with us about the complexities and the process and everything that he needs. So thank you, Scott, very much for being on this podcast with us. And listeners, we'll have some information on the show notes on the name of Scott's company, where to find him. I love LinkedIn, so you can find him on LinkedIn and contact him if you have needs for your product being imported into Japan. So thanks again, Scott, for joining us today.
My pleasure. I hope it was, I brought some.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I was furiously taking notes over here. All right, listeners, we'll see you on the next episode.
That's all for this episode of the International Trade Resource Podcast. We hope you found this discussion insightful and informative. To find more episodes and more information on all things international trade, check out our website at www.intltrade.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite platform to help us spread the word. Join us next time for more exciting insights on the global marketplace. Until then, keep thinking globally.